You're listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 18th of April 2017 on Monocle 24. Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Tom Edwards. On today's programme...
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election to be held on the 8th of June.
UK Prime Minister Theresa May calls for a snap general election. My guests Stephen DL and Geoffrey Kaufman will discuss this and the day's other top news stories, including...
Ma première mesure...
My first act as president will be to give France back its borders. Mass immigration is not an opportunity for France, it is a tragedy for France.
It's the last stretch in the French presidential election as the country prepares to vote in the first round this Sunday. Then, Turkey's president has won a controversial referendum granting him greater powers. So why is Donald Trump congratulating him? And stop the presses, a writer's strike looms in Hollywood. That's all to come here on Midori House with me, Tom Edwards. A warm welcome, as always, to Midori House. My guests today are Stephen DL and Geoffrey Kaufman. Stephen's a writer, broadcaster and Russia analyst. Geoffrey's an Emmy-winning veteran network, television news and war correspondent. Gentlemen, welcome both back to Midori House. We start today's programme elsewhere. In London, where earlier today, UK Prime Minister Theresa May said she wants to hold a snap general election on the 8th of June, adding that the country needed certainty, stability and strong leadership following the EU referendum. Let's take a listen first to her statement today.
I have just chaired a meeting of the Cabinet where we agreed that the government should call a general election to be held on the 8th of June. I want to explain the reasons for that decision. What will happen next, and the choice facing the British people when you come to vote in this election. Last summer, after the country voted to leave the European Union, Britain needed certainty, stability, and strong leadership. And since I became Prime Minister, the government has delivered precisely that. Despite predictions of immediate financial and economic danger, since the referendum, we have seen consumer confidence remain high, record numbers of jobs, and economic growth that has exceeded all expectations. We have also delivered on the mandate that we were handed by the referendum result. Britain is leaving the European Union, and there can be no turning back.
That was Theresa May earlier today. Stephen DL, I'll come to you first of all. Theresa May is demonstrating the leadership, the drive for that same stability, certainty that she claims has been lacking. Is that your reading of what happened today?
To my mind, it's she talks about stability and leadership and so on. I think it's actually an indication of the very opposite, that what she's realised is that she really has a divided country. And she's talked about, I'm Prime Minister for everyone, rich and poor and town and country and all this. And it's absolute nonsense. She realises, you know, that those who voted to stay in are still very anti what has gone on. Those who voted to get out want to get on with it as quickly as possible. The government had no plan at the time of the referendum for what to do if there was a no vote. So they've been doing everything on the hoof. And to my mind, my immediate reaction when I heard this was, this is effectively a second referendum. This is what, you know, she realises she personally doesn't have a mandate. She took over as Prime Minister on a vote from her own party, but not from the people. There is great division in the country. They've said they're not going to have a second referendum, but this is as close as they can get to it.
I completely agree. I think this is a second referendum, except there's only, it's kind of like those old Soviet elections. You can only vote yes, because who do you vote for? If you're against Brexit, you're not going to go vote for Theresa May. But I think a lot of people, including longtime Labour supporters in this country, are going to have a tough time voting for Jeremy Corbyn. Now, just to show you, the third option, of course, one might say is the Lib Dems. But I follow British politics. I didn't even know Tim Farron's name until I looked it up today and discovered that this guy was became the Lib Dem leader in 2015 or 2016. But this guy is so anonymous. The Lib Dems are so marginal that it's really hard, even though they say that they'll come up the middle and they don't want to leave, they don't want Brexit. How do you vote? Either you spoil your ballot or you hold your nose.
And Stephen, this is an important point, isn't it? That, you know, even if we look at in terms of short-term party political expediency, May kind of knows that Labour is not capable of essentially really fighting a well-matched general election campaign. And so at worst, she's going to be left with a bigger majority than she enjoys now, plus that legitimacy that some people claim was lacking.
That is, of course, the piece of the jigsaw which I left out, and Geoffrey picked me up on. She realises that the Labour Party are in such a mess. They've elected Jeremy Corbyn as their leader. Twice there's been huge outcry. So many people who are traditional Labour supporters don't support Jeremy Corbyn and think, my God, you know, if he were Prime Minister, that what would happen? So it is, as Geoffrey said, I'm a little less sceptical about the Liberal Democrats, I have to admit. Actually, I'm a lot less sceptical. And I think we're going to hear an awful lot from them now. Assuming, we must put in this codicil that, of course, Parliament on Wednesday, in theory, could say, no, we don't want a general election soon. And that was a change of some years ago. A government used to have the right to call a general election at 3 weeks' notice whenever it wanted. Now, of course, they don't have that right. The Parliament has to agree to an early election.
Though the Tories presumably could also manipulate it. They could actually work that other piece of legislation out effectively, should they fail to convince Parliament.
I think they'll likely get Corbyn's support.
I'm sure they will, yeah.
Well, isn't this one of the problems, Geoffrey, is that Corbyn, of course, as any political opponent in his situation, has to say, yes, let me take my agenda to the people. This is precisely what I wanted. He's a turkey compelled to vote for Christmas,
isn't he?
He's
the labour ship Titanic and, you know, have a safe passage, Captain Corbyn. It's just not going to happen with Corbyn. I should say that I sat around this table last November predicting Hillary Clinton's victory the day before the election, so let me just...
I remember that.
I like to eat crow a lot, so I like to remind listeners of that. So my prognostications are not exactly spot on. Maybe the Lib Dems can do it, but I do think that this is going to be a single issue election, and quite rightly, because this is the most important decision, Brexit, that this country will make in the lifetime of many people who live in this country, really everyone, particularly the younger generation. And I think you're going to see the danger for Theresa May is that careful what you start, because you don't know where it's going to take you. And it's very easy to imagine Conservative MPs in Brexit, in Remain constituencies being under great pressure to either say, I will vote against it, or facing some sort of revolt. How all of this adds up? Hard to see. Could she get that whopping majority? Yeah. But does that heal the divide in this country? Not a bit.
No, it doesn't. No.
Particularly given that Corbyn is such a non-starter.
Well, Stephen, I wanted to paint a bit of a doomsday scenario for some. A lot of people saying this is going to be Labour wiped out, a historic low. What if in, I don't know, particular heartlands, maybe here in London, Labour kind of do okay, Corbyn clings on, maybe he still gets his several hundred MPs. Could he turn around and say, hey, well, look, this isn't too bad. I'm sticking around. This is the time the party needs me and my alternative agenda. Is there any way that could work?
It could, but I think it's unlikely. As Geoffrey said, we're all, you know, guessing at what might happen, and
it's fun though.
It is. Unfortunately, I'm not a gambling man, so I'm not putting any money on it. And so I recommend no listener to put any money on my words either. But I would reckon on something like a 50-plus seat majority for the Conservatives after this election, which then I would have thought inevitably puts huge pressure on the Labour Party and Corbyn. You know, if Corbyn fails miserably, and that would be a miserable failure, anything like that or worse would be a miserable failure for Corbyn and Labour, then I think that really does put huge pressure from the grassroots of the Labour Party to say, look, we have a man who can't be elected. We can't go through this again 5 years hence. And then you have... what, 5 years for a Labour Party to try and rebuild itself? While, of course, the Brexit is then going through, so you can assume that come the next election, 5 years hence, that we would be out of the...
may have happened. Geoffrey, on that point, I mean, let's say Labour finds some sort of unity candidate as we roll forwards. Let's say we're in 2022, I suppose. Is there somebody who... could, I don't know...
I'm working with you here.
...galvanise the support of the left? Is there somebody who could rein back on Brexit? I mean, it's no given that we definitively would be out by
2022,
then.
Yeah. Listen, I think this is this is going to... June 8th, we've got, 6 weeks? This is really the second referendum that will determine the future of this country for generations and its relationship with Europe. I think that the thing that I would be watching is not 2022. It's these next 8 weeks. Today, the FTSE 100 shot up, the pound shot up to a high of against the euro and the U.S. dollar. There is a large and powerful constituency that is desperate to find a way to stop Brexit. And don't underestimate their resourcefulness and their tenacity in turning this election in their favor, giving people the opportunity to say, hey, wait a minute, we know that there was a lot of anger, but look at the uncertainty that we've unleashed. This is your opportunity. How that adds up, I don't know. Maybe you're right, Stephen. Maybe it is the Lib Dems. You know, I presume the Lib Dems don't even have candidates in most constituencies right now.
No, they said, Tim Fallon said today, that in fact they've been planning for it and they have 300 candidates lined up.
Their kind of grassroots campaigning is one of the few things which has sort of emerged relatively unscathed despite their parliamentary disaster that befell
and,
last time
and you know, statistics and damn statistics, whatever, but they since the referendum last year, they have been the fastest growing political party in this country. Now, you know, we're talking a few thousand, not millions, but that is a fact. Their party has grown. UKIP has kind of fallen apart. Conservatives have pretty well remained steady, and Labour have wavered and tried to tear themselves apart. So there are more potential Lib Dem voters out there.
Yeah, it's a little bit like trying to scale Everest with a piece of string. But I wear my opinions. We get to say what we think on this program. I don't think Brexit's good for the future of this country, and I'll be watching with interest to see whether the Lib Dems can actually make an impression. That's the only possible way I can see this equation changing.
Can I throw something in?
Yes.
What about if there are talks behind the scenes, and in a number of constituencies, the Lib Dems and Labour agree just to put up one candidate?
Would Corbyn do that? Is he that kind of guy?
He may have people telling him that that's the best option they've got. I don't know. I'm just thinking, you know, if there was a Conservative and either a Labour or a Lib Dem, then you've got, you know, for the Remainers, you've got a real, you know, you've got a choice. You know where to make your vote. That's just, you know, that's off the top of my head.
I mean, what do you do if you live in London and you are and you oppose Brexit and you've got a Labour or a Conservative member of Parliament who has to follow party lines? And I guess Labour less than Conservative, it's a real conundrum this election. It's going to be absolutely fascinating to see how people walk this line.
It'll be fascinating for a while. Bear in mind, though, for those of us who live here, it's going to get awfully boring for the next 6 weeks because it's what we're going to hear every day.
At least even it's only 6 weeks. It's not like the US presidential campaign.
This is true.
We should be thankful for small mercies, perhaps. Let's move on and talk about Turkey now, where the country's president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, has won by a slim margin a controversial referendum, granting him greater powers. International observers have called the referendum an uneven contest, with one member claiming that up to 2.5 million votes could have been manipulated. It certainly didn't deter US President Donald Trump from calling Erdogan to congratulate him on his win. Geoffrey Kaufman, just on that point, I guess, again, Donald Trump deals with realpolitik. He has allies he needs to keep on side, whatever the challenge is. He makes a phone call. He congratulates Erdogan. We shouldn't be surprised by that.
Well, I think it picks up a little bit on the Brexit conversation we just had and on Trump himself. This is a highly polarized world we live in. Another 51-49 split. Go figure. You know, that's what Brexit was. That's what Trump's victory was. And that's what's happened in what looks like a slightly questionable referendum in Turkey. We are a world of polarization, and bridging that seems to be is really the challenge of the next decade or two. As for Trump, listen, it's easy to see Trump liking the idea of centralizing power, suppressing opposition. I mean, gee, that sounds pretty good. He's got a pretty thin skin. He doesn't really like the media. Erdogan, can I see what that document is? Because maybe we could change the U.S. Constitution, too. I think the problem is that Trump, you know, Trump's knee-jerk reaction really goes against what the U.S. State Department said, which is a lot more circumspect and says, well, you know, we want to make sure that this follows Turkey's constitution and international agreements. So Trump, as usual, has you know, opened his mouth before he really knowing everything he needs to know.
Well, Stephen, I guess on that exact point, I mean, this could be a thing. We've already seen it a couple of times in the first, well, we're not even at 100 days of Trump. You know, he hears one view for 10 minutes, he chats to someone else and says, actually, who knew that this was as complex as it is? He may do a vault fast within hours, potentially.
He could well. If Fox News says that actually this man's a dictator, then I'm sure his next comment will be, oh, they've got this dictator in Turkey, and no one realizes how much of a dictator he is.
But what about on the serious claim there? We've had observers saying manipulated votes. Obviously, people were unhappy. Erdogan's critics will say, look, this is an increase of a vice-like grip on power. He could be here now for what would be politically generations. I mean, those are legitimate concerns, aren't they?
They are very legitimate concerns. I mean, I've been keeping an eye on Turkey for the last couple of years, particularly looking at it, as it were, from a Russian angle, and that the Russia-Turkey relationship has been very interesting. And in fact, I believe in this very studio, I once did make the comment that Putin and Erdogan have what they have in common is they're both dictators, and I wouldn't go back on that now. And I do find it very well. I find the parallels actually with Russia quite scary. Mm. And you know, doing away with the prime minister, that's a major step in a country which has claimed, well, indeed has been democratic. And you know, Turkey is it's a real conundrum. And that, as Jeffrey said, you know, another 51-49 vote and an international observer's saying it, you know, it looked rather dodgy. And if there were 2 million dodgy votes, then that tips the balance.
Jeffrey, it's interesting. 51-49, you mentioned a few other results that have gone that way. One might say, if perhaps one was rather naive, hey, this is democracy in action. On such narrow margins are these things decided. But this is something rather different, isn't it? And it does prompt broader questions about the very future, presumably, of democracy in Turkey.
Absolutely it does. And it certainly closes the door on Turkey's entrance into the EU, which, let's face it, I don't think very many of us have believed possible for some time, and if ever. I would say one thing, though, about Erdogan that you know, it's easy, and all of these things are true, that he's, you know, it's a power grab, that this is a move towards dictatorship. But it's important to understand that there is some context that explains a logic for people supporting him, which is that unlike Putin, the standard of living for a lot of people in Turkey has improved under Erdogan. Healthcare has improved. Infrastructure investment has been significant. And the very, very aggressive liberal secularism that we in the West may applaud, which banned women, for example, who wore hijabs from attending university, in a country that has some deeply religious, deeply conservative people, there was a lot of resentment. He's opened up the universities to women who wear hijabs, and you know, that may or may not sit well with some of the listeners. But the fact is that this is a country that is divided between a kind of modern Western secularism and a traditional conservatism, religiously based, and he has played into that. And for those people, life is actually better. So it's a more nuanced success on his part that's allowed him to claim a constituency that actually believes in him. Nonetheless, the outcome is, as Stephen says, abolishing the prime minister. I mean, like, this is not good for politics. This man could be in power, what, till 2029, I think, under this new constitution?
Yes.
Steve, just briefly, in terms of how the rest of the world reacts, you know, Turkey is of critical import. It has an extensive border with Syria. You've already alluded to the relationship with Russia and, of course, the overspill that has on Syria, for example. How does the West effectively manage this then, given what may be legitimate concerns about his domestic politics? How do they view Turkey then as a partner in the wider world?
The crucial word you use there is partner, that they have to apply realpolitik, and if this is what the situation is going to be, I mean, the opposition is saying they want a recount or possibly even a rerun. I would doubt that's going to happen. And so let us assume that we have Erdogan there for the foreseeable future. That is the man you've got to deal with. Turkey is too big a country and too crucially located geopolitically. It can't be ignored. Europe can't ignore it. America can't ignore it. Russia can't ignore it. The Middle East can't ignore it. It really is a country at the hub of so many things. And so European leaders are going to try and have to make the best of it. I think they're going to have to say, this is the man we've got to deal with. Somehow we've got to work out some dialogue, because you can't just cut it off.
The 1990s just seem like the golden years when you look back at the stability. I mean, obviously that's spoken from a perspective of affluence and comfort, but you know, it did seem like we really were approaching a world where liberal democracy was the end game. Mm-hmm. And now we're seeing it just isn't so.
And if I can just throw in a quick Russia word, I mean, that was one of the great things about the 1990s. Yes, mistakes were made, but actually there was an awful lot of goodwill on both sides, the West and Russia. No one in Russia at the time, apart from someone like Zhirinovsky, who everyone treated as a joke, no one else called the West an enemy. And that was the 1990s. Yes, those of us who were fortunate enough to live through it and indeed work as journalists through it, we'll look back in our memoirs, that'll be a golden period.
Let's turn next to France. The presidential election enters its final week ahead of the first round of voting this Sunday. Yesterday, the two frontrunners held campaign rallies in Paris, Emmanuel Macron in the Bercy Arena, Marine Le Pen at the Zenith Concert Hall. Jeffrey Kaufman, Emmanuel Macron promised to represent an open, confident, winning France. With that sort of rhetoric, he's going to smoothly proceed to the Élysée Palace, isn't he?
So there's a theme emerging in all of these topics, isn't there? And it's yet again the theme of division. And boy, it's boiling over in France. Can a theme boil over? Let's not go there. But seriously, this is the latest hotspot of polarization, of division. Clearly, Marine Le Pen is speaking for a very large and angry minority. Half of the country, we'll see, when she talks about banning all immigration, and it resonates. This is really yet another place to worry about.
And just on that point, because it's interesting to reflect on what Le Pen said, she ramped up her anti-immigration rhetoric, if there was anywhere left for it to go, and she said she would shield voters from, Stephen, savage globalization. And just to reflect actually on what Jeffrey said, look, this theme we see country to country across borders, is that really the problem if we boil it down? Is it globalization or a fear about it, misunderstandings about it? Is that the thread that runs through all
of these? I think a misunderstanding and also a genuine feeling amongst, in some areas of each of these societies we've been talking about, of people having been left out, left behind. Jeffrey commented earlier, you know, that talking about the 90s from a position of affluence. And yes, you know, there are people, there's people here in Britain, you know, who feel left out. You know, look at the Brexit vote, who feel that they haven't progressed, their salaries or wages haven't gone up, they've lost their jobs, perhaps. You know, there is a significant chunk in each of these societies of people who feel that, you know, who feel they've been left out, and they see globalization, you know, the big brands, the things they're supposed to aspire to, they can't aspire to them because they haven't got the money, and they feel that it's these big companies that, and whether they're right or wrong, but if that's their perception, that company has taken my job or has changed our society, that's, it's actually perception suddenly becomes more important, perhaps, than reality even. If that's how they feel, that's how they're going to vote.
And I don't think it's just globalization. I think that that's part of the equation. I think that it's also the polarization of wealth that came with it, and that is also independent of it. These massive executive salaries, here in London, in the city, in New York, on Wall Street, the extraordinary money that's been made by traders and people who don't actually add value to anything except their own bank accounts, and the kind of resentment that exists in all of these countries when you see the so-called 1% living so well and yet working class, middle class wages frozen, sliding back, people struggling, people juggling two and three jobs just to keep their family fed and housed. And I don't think that's just globalization. I think that's economic policy and concentration of wealth. But the consequence is very much what Stephen says. It's about people feeling left out, people feeling resentful. And it's easy to point at both globalization and immigration and say that's the cause. If we could only stop that, we could turn back the clocks.
A very populist example is football. Football was always, you know, I'm a big football fan. I started watching football 50 odd years ago. And at that time, it was the working men's game. And okay, the players didn't quite get the bus to the stadium as they had done 20 years earlier. But that the way that's going to moved away from the ordinary fan often can't afford to go these days. And yet now there's talk, may not happen, but there is talk that Alexis Sanchez, Arsenal's best player, in order to keep him, they may be paying him £300,000 a week. I mean, this is, you know, more than £1 million a month. What does he do? He kicks a football around. Yes, he does some good charity work back home for his people in Chile. But that just shows such a gulf. It's, you know, it's not just the bankers and the people that we feel, you know, that the ordinary workers might feel are up in high towers and a long way away. It's the guys they go to cheer on every week. They're so far removed from them now as well. And that was, you know, that's a big break in society.
Just finally on this, Geoffrey, and briefly, there's a feeling about, if we look across Europe, we've mentioned a few of these markets, that the very future of Europe is at stake or being called into question by some of the narratives in these elections. Anti-EU candidates making political capital out of that. In a word or two, does the EU bloc then face this existential crisis? I mean, what with Brexit and with, you know, Marine Le Pen has promised a Frexit or whatever it might be in her country. Is it? Have we come to that?
Sure, maybe. I mean, we haven't even talked about North Korea. I think we're just in an era of real instability. I think the world has shifted on its axis, and people who thought that we were in a stable era 10, 15 years ago are seeing that it's a new world order. It's the post-war era, and all of those conventions that. You know, I get the sense that there's a historical amnesia or ignorance that's fueling a lot of this. I mean, the UN, NATO, the EU all came out of the horrors, the devastation of the Second World War, and the idea was that if everybody had to sit in the same room, if everybody had to share a meal together, then it would be much less likely that Europe would descend into violence, into horror a third time, and it did work. But now we've moved into this post-war era and we're writing a new history.
Before we move on, if you want to hear more about the French election specifically, don't forget we're hosting a special live edition of The Foreign Desk on the 11th of May, looking precisely at the results from that previous Sunday. Our speakers include the journalist and author Jonathan Fenby and AFP's London Bureau Chief Florence Biedermann. You can find all the information you need and buy tickets at monocle.com. Finally, on today's programme, the writers are going on strike. Not on this programme. This script is finished. Don't worry, gents. It could be happening in Hollywood. You see what I did
there? That was a gag line. We missed it. Stephen and I are thinking,
it was a joke. I have to telegraph them sometimes. Right. The Writers Guild of America members are voting on whether or not to authorise a strike. Without a deal, all work could stop on the 2nd of May. This will affect the TV show's scripted series and halt writing on a number of film scripts currently in development. Geoffrey Kaufman, just to pick up on a theme we have already touched upon, the poor writers of Hollywood, they're subject to the same thing. There's more money in their business. It's not filtering down to them. Quite right, is it, that they should down tools?
You know, there are really only two issues in this, and it is actually an interesting issue. I don't actually think it fits into the previous conversations. I think this breaks from our theme. there was a wage issue. That's pretty much being resolved. The issue actually goes to the American healthcare system. And the Writers Guild has a really terrific, not even gold, platinum healthcare package. The problem is that the deficit, which was 7 million 3 years ago, is now 25 million for that health for that plan, the health plan. And the studios just don't want to pay to cover this incredibly expensive plan. There are no individual writers who make good middle-class wages, don't pay any premiums, and families pay something like $500. The studios are saying, you know, this just isn't tenable. Don't ask us to pick up everybody pays some premium on their health care plan. The writers are saying, well, wait a minute, you know, we're making less. You want exclusivity when we write for a show. You can't have it all. So, you know, this is about trying to maintain a living standard and trying not to give up. Listen, all of us would fight, as the writers are, to maintain something good.
But they may have a problem of actually not writing themselves out of jobs. Already, one of the problems is they're being paid less because they're writing for series that are now sort of 10, 12, 13 maybe episodes, whereas a few years ago they were 22, 25 episodes. So they've got shorter contracts. But it's something, you know, if people see there's just a whole lot of repeats on television, they'll find something else to do. And it's not really going to affect the film industry too much. I mean, the last strike 10 years ago was for 100 days. In 100 days, you know, films are still being made and films come out a much longer time span. So the films will carry on. And particularly the younger generation will find something else to do. They don't watch television as much as they used to anyway.
There you go. Another dose of reality from our panellists here at Midori House. And that brings us to the end of today's programme. Thanks to Stephen DL and to Jeffrey Kaufman. Thanks both for being with us. Today's show was produced by Carlotta Ribello, research by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Antia Longo. Our studio manager was Kieran Banerjee. More music next with Carlotta. Section D on the way at 1900, the Daily coming up at 2200. Thanks for listening.